I've tried lots of adventurous stuff, like surfing in Hawaii or jumping out of an airplane in a tandem skydive, but I've never tried this one. Hi, I'm Nick Vujicic at lifewithoutlimbs.org. I was born without arms and legs. I'm talking about walking a tightrope. In 1859, Charles Blondin attempted to become the first person to cross a tightrope stretched over a quarter of a mile across the Niagara Falls. He performed his daring feats several different ways. One time he crossed in a sack, one time on stilts. But this guy, Blondin, wanted to make it a little bit more interesting. So he proceeded to walk across, check this out, blindfolded, while pushing a wheelbarrow. He turned to the spectators and asked, "Do you believe I can carry a person in the wheelbarrow?" The crowd cheered, "Yes, yes, we do." "Okay then, get into the wheelbarrow." The crowd went silent. The illustration is clear. Sometimes we look at God like he's some kind of crazy high wire stunt artist who doesn't make sense and maybe can't be trusted. But listen, he's entirely trustworthy to get you to the other side of any problem you're facing today, big or small. Check out Hebrews chapter 10, verse 23. It says, "Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful." Are you thinking about something right now that's got you scared out of your mind? A decision you need to make that requires faith? Hey, you can trust your God. Do the right thing. Take the step. He who promised is faithful.
You're listening to Nick Vujicic at lifewithoutlimbs.org.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning and welcome to Disability Forum here on Life FM 93.1 with Eric Wright through until 9:30 this morning. And on the program today, we will be talking about people describing how the drug cocaine nearly ruined their lives, a story of a mother whose two-year-old son has leukemia, and also why clinical trials are very important. And before we start, we'd just like to say best wishes to everybody starting the Leaving Cert this morning. 116,000 students doing the Junior Cert and the Leaving Cert. So the best of luck to all of you. And I know the weather is beautiful outside, and hopefully it's going to last. And that's the usual with when the Leaving Cert or Junior Cert is on, the weather becomes beautiful. But hopefully that you'll sail through the exams, and that when you finish the exams, that the sunshine will continue through the summer. So the very best of luck to one and all from all of us here on Life FM 93.1. This is a Disability Forum.
I do cocaine and think, what the hell is all this about? What's the fuss? But for me, the lights went on. And for me, it changed my life. It nearly killed me.
1-3% of the population, you know, have used cocaine or are using cocaine at any one time, which means that it's quite a prevalent issue and something which, you know, affects many people in society.
I was a late starter with Class A's. So I don't think it was until I was about 19. I think it was, you know, a way to belong.
Cocaine is seen by some people as a rather glamorous drug. That's a complete illusion.
I started working in the media, and I went to this club, and it was very glamorous, lots of famous people, and you know, very expensive, very exclusive, and I was offered cocaine. I kind of bought into the dream of cocaine, as many people do, that it's a sign of having made it, or it's kind of part of show business and all of that stuff. And I didn't really think twice. I went to the toilet and I did my first line of cocaine. And, yeah, I thought, I've arrived.
People that use cocaine do not have glamorous lives. People with glamorous lives, with good lives, lose the quality of their life through cocaine.
Bad stuff happened from that first night, but at the time, I had the blinkers on. That later that night, I was sick in a plant pot in a VIP room. You know, that's not very glamorous. Right from that first night, I passed out on a bus later on when I came down and ended up in the middle of nowhere, really dangerous, very vulnerable for a young woman on her own.
Cocaine has effects on the heart, causing abnormal heart rhythms. In extreme situations, it can cause the heart to go into heart failure, even to stop completely.
And there came a point where I became so sensitive to the adrenaline part of cocaine that I would be physically sick. You know, and at first that was shocking. You know, I'd go out for a really lovely dinner on a Friday night, score, do a line, and be sick, you know. And that was horrible, but it's like, oh, well, that's just the way it is.
Many people take cocaine powder by snorting it. What happens is the tissues in the nasal cavity die, so that the nose loses its shape and ultimately collapses.
There are lots of physical things that happen with cocaine as it progresses. You know, I'm fortunate I didn't get crack lung, because I didn't smoke crack cocaine very often. At first, it was a treat drug. You know, it was birthdays, it was special occasions, it was, oh, wow, fantastic night out. But slowly, I didn't even notice. I couldn't have that great night out if I didn't have a wrap of cocaine on me.
I was a weekend user. I used to go to parties and have some coke and just with friends and stuff like that. And then my best mate died, and it was like just instinct, really. I can't really say that it was something I consciously did, but I just knew, you know, my instinct knew that there was something that takes the pain away. And you know, I think even at his funeral there was a bunch of us there, and we all chipped in and got like a couple of grams of coke, do you know what I mean? And that was it. You know, from then on, it was just turned into a very bad relationship, and I just did a lot of it, a lot.
When people start using cocaine, they've got no idea how quickly use can escalate, because, of course, people will neglect other things in their lives and not be aware of it. So there's a complete lack of insight and awareness as to how quickly the problem's developing. By that time, when people maybe realise there's a problem, it's often damaged their health and sort of well-being generally.
Over the space of a year, I just used to just do an outrageous amount. It was like a minimum of a gram a day and up to about 6 grams a day. I'd be snorting coke off my bedside table before I got out of bed. And that was like that every day. That was just my life.
Cocaine rules their lives. It gets in the way of them being able to carry out normal, you know, proper relationships with other people, with family, with friends, with boyfriends, girlfriends.
You're not going to get like normal kind of partner, are you, in that sort of situation? You're not going to get a girl that's kind of normal, down-to-earth girl not being interested in you. It's going to be someone else who's also an addict.
The people around me were like me. You know, there were people who, they're not going to tell me I've got a problem, because they're doing it in the way that I'm doing it. You know, when I went home to my family, I could see the change from the person I was to the person I was becoming, and that was unpleasant, so I kept my family at arm's length. And increasingly, I was getting more and more depressed and not liking who I was. I could no longer go to work. You know, I was in pieces. I had a kind of breakdown. I wanted to kill myself. I couldn't see a way out. And I was very fortunate that I was able to go into rehab.
I never liked it much, even when I was on coke myself. And the kind of coke personality, you know. Coke is like an ego drug. It's like confidence. So it's like everyone on coke tends to be really overconfident, you know. And just do your head in, you know. You get talked at, don't you, by people on coke. It's horrible.
People, when they take cocaine, some often claim that they are, you know, really confident, they're being themselves. And all that's happening is that they're losing their inhibitions.
I treated people in really horrible ways. I thought I was more important than anybody else, pretty much. You know, I was in that egotistical, coke-fueled state a lot of the time. But I couldn't see it, because the addiction had me, you know. It cast its little spell.
Cocaine is a very powerful drug. It has a very powerful effect on people's lives. It's only when they come for help does the enormity of the problem hit them.
I never say to people, don't take drugs, because I know that if anybody had said that to me, I'd have laughed at them. What I do say to people is, get the facts about drugs. Don't get your education from the tabloids. Don't look at those glossy pictures, those touched up pictures, and think, wow, that's a lifestyle I want. You know, cocaine does not make you successful. You know, talent or creativity or whatever it is the thing that makes you successful. You know, cocaine actually destroys a lot of those things, ultimately.
If I like a drug, then I used to do it. There was no limit at all. That's why I don't do any at all now.
It was kind of like the colour kind of drained out of my life, it felt. Yeah, unless there was cocaine there. And initially, cocaine would put the colour back in and it would make everything great again. But then over a period of time, things got blacker and blacker and blacker. I'd had no understanding that addiction isn't just about the substance. Addiction is about, you know, having to use substances to change the way you feel because you can't cope with being you.
Well, there you have it. Two people describe how the drug nearly ruined their lives, cocaine. And if you have an addiction to drugs, there are many local, regional and national services that can support you. Whether you need for information, advice, support or counselling to treatment and rehabilitation, you can find the full listings of services. The HSE Drugs Helpline can be reached on free phone 1-800-459-459. That's the HSE Drugs Helpline on 1-800-459-459. And that service is open Monday to Friday between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. And this service also offers support information, guidance and referrals to anybody with a question or concern relating to these services. And of course, you can also contact your local GP as well for referrals and to talk to your GP. Remember, your GP is there to support you.
lymphoblastic leukemia, or ALL, is a form of cancer of the blood. It's derived from the lymphocyte-producing cells in the bone marrow. Acute leukemia develops when these lymphocyte-producing cells, for reasons we don't necessarily fully understand, stop maturing properly and or also gain the ability to divide or proliferate more quickly. And this means that you have a build-up of these very immature lymphocytes or lymphoblasts within the bone marrow. And this means that the normal bone marrow cells are crowded out.
Yeah. Well, when Josh was about 2.5, he started going back to crawling rather than walking. First thing in the morning, he'd say his legs were too sore to walk, and he'd get out of bed and crawl around for the first half an hour or so, and then start walking after that. That was the main symptom. He had pains in his legs, which would come and go. He was also quite pale at that time.
Some of the symptoms are anemia, so tiredness, short of breath, lethargy. Infections, high fevers, maybe mouth ulcers, bleeding, bruising, and rashes. Together with, most children will have enlargement of some lymph nodes, so often around the neck or in the groin, and often the liver and spleen may also be enlarged. The other symptom which is quite common is bone pain, and this is one of the symptoms that actually is quite prominent and often takes some time to diagnose. The initial treatment, whilst we're waiting to confirm that diagnosis, is mainly supportive. So that might include fluids for hydration, antibiotics if they've got an infection or a fever, maybe a blood transfusion or a platelet transfusion. Chemotherapy is a general term, really, that encompasses a lot of different drugs, and these can be given in tablet form, or they may be given into the bloodstream directly, or they may be given into either muscle injections or subcutaneous injections. And there are some drugs that are given into the central nervous system via a lumbar puncture called intrathecal chemotherapy.
You get the nausea and just feeling tired, and the hair loss, obviously. Joshua lost his hair 3 times throughout the treatment. That was each time the treatment was intensified. It's a 3-year course of treatment, and the first 9 months is intensive treatment, and then the rest of that's maintenance therapy. So I think it was in the first 9 months that he lost his hair 3 times, probably once every 3 months or so. And
the majority of children with ALL will go into remission after their initial treatment, and over 75 to 80% of those are cured, so we have a very good response rate. There is a small proportion of children that won't go into remission, and those children will probably require individual care by their individualised care rather by their specialist, and may require intensification of treatment, for instance with a stem cell transplant.
Sounds initially very daunting and very scary, but I think once you realise, you start to adjust and you start to recognise what's going to happen and become familiar with the treatment, you do feel a lot more at ease. So it's not all as fraught as it is in the early days.
I think the things to bear in mind are this is a curable disease and the majority of children will be cured. That your primary treatment centre and your shared care centre will do whatever they can to enable the child's treatment to go as smoothly as possible and to have as minimal disruptions to the child and to the family and brothers and sisters.
There you go, that's Angela describing how she dealt with her 2-year-old son's leukemia diagnosis, and an expert there as well, giving you the common symptoms and the treatment options as well. You're with Disability Forum here on Life FM 93.1 with Eric and Mary, right through until around 9:35 this morning. And it's the 5th of June, and you're very welcome along to the show. By the way, also, if you want information about cancer, you can contact the National Cancer Helpline, free phone 1-800-200-700. That's 1-800-200-700. And you can talk to a specialist now, Monday to Thursday between 9 a.m. and 7 p.m., and Friday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Or you can email helpline at irishcancer.ie. That's all one word, lowercase, helpline at irishcancer.ie.
If you're already pressed for time, the last thing you want to do is come home to a messy house. Have Faye clean your house, business or car for you without breaking the bank. Whether you need a regular general cleaning, a once-off service before or after an event, the carpets are due for a shampoo, or your car needs darting. Call Faye for a quality, efficient and affordable cleaning service on 086-0569-139. That's 086-0569-139.
Imagine waking up in a charming, spacious holiday home in a relaxed rural town in Brittany, France. Supermarkets, restaurants and swimming pool all close. Only 30 minutes from golden sandy beaches with surfing, canoeing, sailing, golf, walks, cycle trails and activity parks all nearby. Not to mention the shopping and the food, cooked only as the French can. Lettings weekly to fit in with ferries. Don't just imagine. Phone Hugh on 087-2535-122. 087-2535-122 for more information. Go on, you deserve a break.
Hi, this is Brian Daly, station manager of Life FM. If you enjoy the music and programs you hear daily on Life FM and feel this is one radio station that needs to continue its mission of reaching out to our community with hope and encouragement, then we'd like to ask you to prayerfully consider making a donation to help with the broadcast expenses, such as electricity, rent and music licensing fees. Your donation, whatever the amount, will be most appreciated. Only 5% of our support comes from advertising. The remainder comes from listeners like you. Life FM is a registered charity. Our address is Unit G, Dean Rock Offices, Dean Rock, Toker, Cork. For more information, you can call us on 021-496-4444 or email us on info@lifefm.ie. That's info@lifefm.ie.
A clinical trial is the best way we have of finding out which treatment works for a particular condition. It's the most fair test, if you like, of a treatment. In a clinical trial, we can compare one treatment against another in the most fair way possible, and then we can find out which one works the best. Anybody can take part in a clinical trial. It does depend, though, on whether somebody is already running a clinical trial on the treatment, which you might have, and whether you fit their recruitment categories. People are building huge databases that collect together all of the activity that's happening in the clinical trials community all around the world to produce a searchable database so that people can look for trials. So there are some clear advantages to participating in a clinical trial. Sometimes, if it's a trial of a new treatment that isn't widely available, you may have access to a treatment which you wouldn't otherwise have been able to get. But also it's worth being clear that there are some disadvantages of participating in a clinical trial. And most of those revolve, I think, around inconvenience. And that cuts both ways. So, for example, if somebody is running a clinical trial, they may want to know a lot more about your health. So they'll have to do many more blood tests, or maybe you'll have to come back to clinic and be examined or checked up on more commonly than you otherwise might have been. You could regard that as an intrusion and a disadvantage. You could regard it as an advantage. One of the fears that people have about clinical trials is that maybe they'll be given some new and very elaborate experimental drug. Firstly, that's very unusual, very uncommon, but secondly, before you start the trial, people will explain to you very carefully and very clearly which treatments you may be getting. One worry that people sometimes have about participating in a clinical trial is that they might be given a treatment which subsequently turns out not to have been the best of the two options. The problem, of course, is that at the time that you're running a trial, the time that you're choosing which treatment is best, you don't know which is the best treatment. And actually, that's quite common in medicine. What happens in a clinical trial is you're still being given one of two treatments chosen at random, in exactly the same way that you might have if your doctor was treating you as usual outside of a clinical trial, but without any clear evidence. But at least in a clinical trial, we're developing new understanding of which treatments work best. When you participate in a clinical trial, people will give you an enormous amount of information. But at the very beginning stages, when you are thinking about participating in that trial, there are a few questions that I think I'd be interested in asking. Firstly, I'd want to know, what's the point of this trial? What's the uncertainty that you're trying to resolve? Secondly, I'd want to know, what do we already know about the two treatments which I might be getting? Thirdly, and I think this is very important, I'd want to know, will you tell me the results of the trial when it's finished? And lastly, I'd want to know, will the results of this clinical trial definitely be published and put into the public domain? I think I would always participate in a clinical trial if I was invited, because firstly, I feel that I have nothing to lose if I don't know which of the two treatment options available to me is the best. Secondly, I might benefit, I might get a better treatment. But lastly, I would feel that I was contributing to the greater sum of our knowledge. I was helping us to understand for everybody in the future which treatment is the best. The reality is, the only reason why we are effective as doctors at treating any disease is because people have already participated in clinical trials. They are really the only way that we know if a treatment works or not. And so the people who've participated in those trials have made an enormous contribution, not just to the knowledge of doctors and academics, but more importantly, an enormous contribution to everybody's health.
That's Dr. Ben Goldacre there explaining about clinical trials, and hopefully it gave you a better understanding of how it's actually done. So it's coming up now to 9:31 here on Disability Forum at Life FM 93.1 with Eric and Mary, and we come to the end of the programme, and we do hope that you found it informative, and that you'll join us again next Wednesday just after 9. Thank you very much indeed to Mary for producing the show. And if you want to contact the show, it's disabilityforum@lifefm.ie. That's disabilityforum@lifefm.ie. So all that's left for me to say is have yourself a lovely week. Take care of yourselves and tune in again after 9 next Wednesday here on Life FM 93.1. Up next is Focus on the Family, and then Anna Daly sets the agenda for the day with On the Level. We leave you with Imelda May, Proud and Humble. Bye-bye for now.